You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the Comedians Comedian Podcast, which takes your favourite comedians and the ones you haven't become enamoured with yet but are about to, and takes their creative process and puts it under the microscope and then tries to make them personally cry. Today we hit a stone wall on that front with the incredible Julio Torres. Probably my favourite moment of this interview is the bit where I ask him if he's able to change gear in the incredibly unique style that he has, and we're going to go into it on depth. He was just one of my very favourite acts at Edinburgh last year, and I've been saving this one up for a snowy day. I ask him if he's able to change gear using his unique pace in the type of show that he's doing, which we'll go into detail. He looks me in the eye and pauses and says, no. It's absolutely wonderful. I've got so much time for Julio. Congratulations for downloading this. If you're a British listener and haven't heard of him, he doesn't have a massive profile over here, but I hope he comes back here and does more work soon. He's a writer for SNL and also one of the most sort of starkly creative and just enthralling performers that I've seen in a very long time. His show last year was the first one on my lips whenever anyone asked me at the festival if I'd seen anything, if I could recommend anything. I couldn't wait to tell people about this joyously, seemingly impossible, fantastic comedian. So, without further ado, this is Julio Torres. Oh, sorry, there is a bit more ado. Isn't that the worst? That's like introducing someone at a comedy club, getting everyone clapping and then making them stop before you do it again. I'm sorry, with this tiny bit more ado, I am, of course, on tour. So sorry if you were going to come to the Dublin show. I know there's lots of disappointed people there. I'm afraid because of the Beast from the East, that show was cancelled. We weren't even able to postpone it and find an alternative date. So I'm really sorry if you missed out there. I hope I can get to see you and you can get to see me soon. Stay tuned in the middle bit and I will tell you about some of my forthcoming tour dates. Now, without any further ado at all, this is the absolutely enthralling Julio Torres. Let's start with your show. I saw your show. It's such a great show.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me about, tell me about the creation of the show. I've been coming to the Edinburgh Festival for over 20 years, and yeah, I've never seen anyone with a video camera pointed at their hands to a video screen as they discuss their favourite shapes. I couldn't not go and see it. So tell me about that show and how it relates to your stand-up practice.
Sure. I think that I have always been a very visual person since before I even attempted doing comedy. And I've always found a lot of humor in objects. And then it feels like parallel to that, I started doing stand-up, occupying sort of a different part of my brain. And then I think mainly through, this sounds stupid, but mainly through Instagram, I started sort of experimenting and posting just objects that I think are funny and just sort of riffing on them and talking about them and personifying them. And then I always thought, well, what a shame that I can't really do this via stand-up, because I can't really hold a small object that is like a centimeter long in a stand-up set and talk about it. And then it just sort of occurred to me, well, what if I point a camera and I magnify these small objects that I find so stimulating and I talk about them? And yeah, that's how that show came about.
And is that, so was that show created for festivals or for this festival?
No.
Or how old is
no,
the show?
That show was very cathartic in that I was suddenly excited that I could do live what I had previously only been able to do through video or photographs.
Okay.
So then I put that show together very quickly, and then the possibility of bringing it to Edinburgh came about.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is the some of the stand-up elements from the show,
yes,
not that you're standing up, but some of the... You know, your
jokes.
Opening, some of the jokes,
yes,
yeah. Your opening, yeah, line is, you know, the Vegan Queer Collective,
sure,
line. That's from your pre-existing stand-up,
yes,
practice.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it is. But I found that a lot of what I do in stand-up connects, or at least my brain connects that somehow to the elements that I bring in visually. Yeah. So I almost see it like when I'm sitting doing the show... Like, my set list is this collection of this little menagerie. And that is sort of like the list of jokes I have to get through.
Okay, okay. So yeah, rather than a set list, you've literally got a box. I mean,
yeah,
it's lovely.
I literally have a display of beautiful little objects.
I think the, like, I have now recorded something like 230 interviews, and I don't know how old you are. How old are you?
I'm 30.
30?
Yes.
You are the only person who has ever said this part of my comedy practice was inspired by Instagram. I'm like, oh, that is the, you might be my most millennial guest.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I actually find social media to be very productive comedically. And I think that, I mean, a lot of comedians and stand-ups have a productive relationship with Twitter mainly.
Sure.
Because you get to just think of a funny thing and release it into the world. And so a lot of stand-ups do that because it's words. But I found that Instagram, when I find, 'cause I didn't have it for the longest time because I didn't necessarily, I wasn't necessarily interested in, but then I realized, oh, I can just experiment comedically with this, and I, yeah.
So what were some of the first steps you took in that kind of experimentation?
Well, just, I think I was pleasantly surprised the first time that I noticed that people found funny what I found funny, when I would just take a picture of an object that I found was preposterous and just personify it.
Okay.
And then I noticed, oh, I'm not crazy, because other people are also enjoying this, I think. A lot of the time, to be honest, though, including with this show that you saw, it is actually very hard for me to tell whether people find what I'm doing funny or they find my interest in it funny.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. Okay.
Sometimes I wonder, okay, so you just laughed at me commenting on the curvy angles of this vase, but are you laughing because you agree with me, or are you laughing because you think I'm odd?
And, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Or
and I think it's
even
a little, or not even odd, but just like, I mean, there's something appealing, I think, about someone who has very particular interests.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because
I
feel like I have laughed at jokes. I laugh all the time at jokes about sports because I understand more or less what the, knowing nothing about sports, no, I understand more or less what the joke is, but I also find myself amused by the passion that the comedian is displaying regarding the subject.
Yes.
So maybe that's what most of the audience is.
I think of Daniel Tosh whenever I think of sports jokes, because he is someone who just like throws you in at the deep end in terms of your understanding of sport, which perhaps like yourself, mine is absolute zero. So he'll do jokes about, in particular, American sports.
Yeah.
And they're very barbed, very pointed jokes. And I find myself having to, I'm picking up what he's talking about from my knowledge of comedy, not my knowledge of sport. I'm going, oh, they're laughing at that point, so that must mean there's some relationship between that thing and that thing.
I think that people that are not from America, like you or I, develop that sort of, I don't completely understand this, but I'm sort of doing the math in my brain to understand it.
Yes.
More than Americans, because everything that we consume, or most of the things that we consume, are foreign to us.
Yes.
So I think that plays into like our understanding of a Daniel Tosh joke,
sure,
for example.
Sure.
Because we're so used to when we turn on the television and we watch, or when we go to the movie theater and watch a movie, or when we see a comedy on TV, there's a huge chance that that is foreign to us in some way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm just thinking back to my experience of watching you, and part of the delight of watching you was certainly the alienness of how you're... I mean, you have this... I don't know quite what the relationship is, but I know that there's Space Prince Julio is a kind of sort of either a persona of yours or a sort of a shorthand for what it is that you do. And I was feeling like I was enjoying the alienness. Part of me was just the thrill of going, I didn't know you could do this with comedy. I've seen so much comedy. I didn't know you could do this. And part of it was I was thinking about how much my wife was going to enjoy your show. Because I thought, this is complete. And she did. She absolutely loved it. And yes, part of it is simply relishing the relish with which you commit to.
Sure.
Yeah. The excitement of the, I forget the name of the brooch, but the bit about her people are going to ask for the world and we're going to give it to them. Like that. Yeah. I mean, God, I've told so many people, that's my like, you've got to go see this guy. What does he do? He does this. Like, that's the bit that I use because it is so alien to everyone's experience of comedy.
I mean, I love that you got that sense from it because I enjoy it and feel comfortable in that. In that role, in the quote-unquote alien role, which I think is a magnified, just sort of magnifying the experience of being literally an alien in America. Like, I just filled out a form online, a government form, just changing my address. Because when you're foreign in America, you have to inform the government that you're moving.
Okay.
And even that form, the title of it was Aliens Change of Address. and it just, like, I think just sort of that label always spoke to me.
Yes.
And because I always felt a little out of place anywhere to begin with. So in magnifying that, I think that's where I found what I enjoy in comedy.
And there is something so kind of... almost archetypal about your presence on stage, your pace, the fact that you had glitter not just on your face, but like your hands were glistening. You would just occasionally see that in the light.
Yes. Thank you for noticing.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. I
wonder
it.
Every day when I put it on, I wonder, is this for me or is it noticeable from the audience?
What's the difference? I'll come back to that first off. Yeah. What's the difference between something being for you and something being for the audience? That seems like a good way to get into what you do.
I rarely think of the audience, I guess. A lot of it starts being for me. And then the surprise and my delight comes when I feel like people are connecting to it. Because we all know that if you make something generic just as a product... It, I don't know, there's something artificial about it. Whereas if you make something very personal, people will connect to it in some way.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So you're glistening. You're this kind of space prince character, but it's not a character. It is. It has a truth, and the truth is very apparent.
Yes, I've been. I remember the first time someone said that they enjoyed the character I do on stage. And the first time I heard that, I think it was like at an open mic or something like that. And I was just so puzzled by someone calling it a character. Because to me, I can't imagine performing my comedy any other way. Like, well, it's like, well, what do you mean a character? Like, okay.
It's really interesting hearing the pace with which you speak and the rhythm with which you speak now, conversationally. And that is exactly identical to the pace that you speak with on stage. Like, one of my questions was going to be about that opening joke. I mean, you spend maybe 10 seconds saying the word hello at the beginning of your show.
Yes.
You know, which I was immediately, this is great. Look at the... Not even necessarily the risk. You seem impervious to risk on stage, because 99% of the performers at this festival are coming on stage and going, "Hi, how you doing? You know, where are you from? How are we doing? Is everyone good?" You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you seem very deliberately to say, "Hello, I'm Julio." You know, and it's
sure.
just
you
I
know,
love
I,
it.
And again, like that was like something that I think a friend picked up on, and he mentioned that he thought it was funny, so I kept doing it. But the first time I would spend too much time greeting the audience was because I thought, oh God, I'm so cold that I should acknowledge that I know that they're here. And that I just sort of respect their presence. And you know, like...
You were opening without, hello, this is me. You were just doing that pace and going straight into the first joke. Oh,
yeah.
See.
And then I remember thinking, like, oh, no, I should say hi, because they're there. So I should say hi. It was, like, I think years ago, and I don't know if it was Jay Leno or, like, it was probably Jay Leno who... I remember reading somewhere a long time ago, before I started doing comedy, that like there was a deliberate decision that Jay Leno would, at the beginning of his show, come out and shake the hands of the people in the audience that were closest to the stage, just sort of establishing him as this like everyday relatable guy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm trying to do with the hello, hello, hello. Just I'm warm.
Yes.
Hello, I am warm.
Yeah. But I think there is something like that contains the seed of the whole act, is needing to say, hello, I am warm.
is
in itself an incredibly alien way to get that across.
Sure. Yeah.
There is what I found was so arresting about it was it immediately made me think of seeing you on, say, were I to see you do a 7-minute spot on a bill of five other acts.
Yes, which is what I do most of.
Yeah, sure. Yes. So to start with that, it's captivating, because you say, I'm doing this all on my terms, and I'm coming. You say to the audience almost, I'm coming to you humbly, and also.
Sure.
It says something incredible to status, because you appear to be vulnerable, yet you're completely in control.
Yeah, I will say that this show, I mean, sometimes it goes fantastically and sometimes it doesn't. And the same goes for doing a spot in a longer showcase. But even when the audience is hating it, they are still very attentive. So I at least know that they're disliking it, but they're making an informed decision.
That's lovely. When it goes wrong, when you feel like they're hating it, how quickly do you get that sense? Do you know straight away?
A second into the performance.
And what is it that they do or don't do that makes you go, it's not going to go?
They do not laugh.
Just straight off. They don't laugh at that opening.
Yeah. They find it they immediately recognize that this is not what they hoped it would be. They immediately see me sit on that, behind that table, greet them, and they think, oh no.
Oh no.
This is not, we're not going to be hearing about the things that we hoped that we'd be hearing, whatever those may be.
The promotional material was not ironic. This is a man discussing his favorite shapes. That's
yeah, and I made it a point to, because of course he had the fringe, there's that big culture of flyering, and
sure.
and which I was surprised that most of the festival moves on the backs of these wonderful people who are like flyering for the shows. And something that I was very adamant about was, please don't tell them that this is a stand-up show. Like, please don't, because if they just say it is humorous, but if they come expecting a very, very funny stand-up set from a guy that's coming from America who is Latino or whatever, then oh no, then we're in trouble.
And do you, when you're in trouble,
yeah,
are there gears that you can shift? Are there
none? None. No. When there's an iceberg ahead, I navigate straight to it because I think, well, first of all, practically, logistically, I can't give them another show.
No, of course.
Right? Because I can't. If I were up there doing, just behind a microphone, doing a stand-up hour, then I could, in my brain, maybe retool it quickly, as we all have, and just sort of trying to give them what I think they want.
But would you have an interest in doing that? Have you done that
no,
in the past?
No, I stay the course, and I'm going to give them what I prepared.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, I'm not. No, I don't revise anything. And if within a second I know that they're not enjoying it, I have, you know, 50 minutes left. I think, well, this is now performance art.
Yes, which, to be honest, sorry, don't let me interrupt you.
Yeah, and now I will do it in silence, and some may get something out of it, and some won't.
Do people ever come around? Do you get a sense with an audience like they're not going to go for it, and then by the end you think, actually, some of these people have kind of turned on?
Well, no. Yeah. The show, I will say that the show is so varied in its content,
mm-hmm.
that maybe at some point someone, you know, hated the little glass swan, but is for whatever reason on board on the sphere or whatever that I show. But no, rarely ever do they come around. And it's just sort of, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you order something and then the food comes and it's not what you were picturing. It doesn't look like you were picturing. And then you take a bite. And it's certainly not what you were hoping for. And then you get a little angry. And then you take another bite, hoping that it'll change. But of course it hasn't. It's still the same thing. That's, I think, what audiences that don't like the show experience
yes.
with.
Yes.
With it.
So where do you, in you as a human being,
mm-hmm.
where does the self-belief come from? To do something so wildly different to the norm?
Well, first of all, I have never done something thinking this is wildly different from the norm.
Okay.
I wasn't like, ha, wait till they see this.
I'm going to blow their minds.
To me, it was like, oh, this makes perfect sense because how else would I show them the little objects? To me, it was as insane as doing like a funny slideshow, which we have come to accept as a thing that people do. Yeah, I don't think I've ever done something thinking, wow, this is so insane, their minds are going to be blown.
Sure.
No, I always find like, no, I mean, what else would I do? Yeah.
So you're, when you first stepped on stage, tell me about the circumstances under which you first found yourself stepping on a comedy stage.
I was a year after college, more or less, after completing college school in America. I had to sort of figure myself out pretty quickly because when you're foreign in America and you go there to be an international student, the government essentially gives you a year to figure to find a sponsor, a work sponsor, and then stay in the States. And I wasn't having a great time about it. It was a pretty difficult time because I really, really wanted to stay in the States, and finding a sponsor was, as anyone who's gone through that process, was difficult. But during that stage, I feel like I was molding in what I would become. And then I thought, well, I feel like I'm spending so much of my life here in New York trying to find a job, and that doesn't feel like I'm not having any fun, and I don't feel like I'm being creative at all. And that's why I came here to begin with. And I was very adamant about the idea of becoming a television writer and a screenwriter and a theater writer. That's what I wanted to do. And I felt like, oh my God, like, what if I'm not here tomorrow? You know, I don't have the time to find actors or a camera or a stage.
And make mistakes.
And make mistakes and who is this for? And no one had any interest in working with me, really, because no one knew who I was, hadn't done anything, so why would they? And then I sort of thought, well, what is the one thing I can do that I don't have to spend any money on, because I have no money, I don't have to ask anyone's permission to do, that I can do? Immediacy is such an important part of my life. I want everything, and I want it now. And what can I go do literally tonight? And then it just occurred to me, oh, what about stand-up? It's literally a microphone and a stage. That seems like the quickest, most efficient way of getting out there in the world that my writing. So I Googled New York stand-up open mic, and I went to the first one.
Had you been to a comedy club before?
No.
And did you have friends that were comics?
No.
So it was purely a sort of a mathematical decision?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend, and had this friend at that point too, who very into comedy, but it wasn't until later that we collaborated or anything. But,
okay.
Yeah.
So this is Julio. You can hear how much fun I'm having. What an incredible act. Honestly, I know I talk about it in this episode, but simply having a show called My Favourite Shapes and it being about his favourite shapes, which he shows you in detail and talks about, it absolutely blew my mind, completely redefined for me what was possible. And remember, I'm the sort of hoary old act who's been... I mean, this Edinburgh will be my 25th, not all as a stand-up, we know. That's not an opportunity to take a drink. But in 25 years of the Edinburgh Festival, this absolutely sticks out as one of the top five weirdest and most magical things I saw. So really, really exciting to talk to him. Thank you to Julio for coming on the show. And we will get back right into that in a moment. Little bit of business. Thank you to those of you who've donated recently. Let's have a little shout out to everyone who has donated in the last couple of weeks. Chris,
Jeff, John, Robert. Thank you, Robert. That's another one. Who's that? Colin. Surely some women have also donated. Leighton, sounds like a guy. Callum, definitely a guy. David, come on, let's have at least one female donor. There have been some, I know there have. Andrew, sounds a bit male. Annie, thank you, Annie. There we go, just keen to point out that it's not entirely male listenership. So thank you to everyone that has donated in the last 2 or 3 weeks. I've got a huge list. I've got 47 emails. I wish they were all donation-based. 47 emails to get back to in my get back to this when you've got a second file. And I haven't had many seconds recently with the tour and the weather and the boy and all the rest. So, oh, little update on I will update you next week on the status of Everyone's a Comedian. Because the cat's out of the bag on that. I thought it was all hush-hush. And then it suddenly turned up on comedy.co.uk and some other blogs here and there. So if you are excited about that, it's happening on Tuesday. And I will tell you all about it and how it went. In as much as I'm allowed to do so, unless it's been blabbed all over media, I will tell you about that next time we speak. But that has been occupying my time, so apologies for those of you who've donated and emailed me on a variety of sometimes helpful, sometimes obfuscatory topics. Couple of emails I just wanted to read from. This is an email from Michael. Stu, I felt compelled to get in touch with you after you uploaded your live show as a free podcast. That's the album Compared to What, which is still available on the feed. I removed it and then thought, no, sod it, I'll put it back on. He says, I've been following your interview series for some time now. I mean, that dignifies it, and I like it very much. Hearing your passion for the art, your ability to connect with a wide range of your peers makes for entertaining and enlightening series of interviews. The point is, I haven't particularly hunted you out to see live. Go on, Michael. He says, I can't explain why. Well, don't then. Just not been motivated to do so. But I listened to your hour today and was massively impressed. Shit, I sound patronising now. Please don't take it that way. Too late, mate. One of the most finely crafted hours I've heard for ages. He's throwing it back. With a huge punchline to words ratio. Now that is what... I'm sorry to keep interrupting Michael's email. But a huge punchline to words ratio. That's music to my ears. And that's exactly how you should compliment a comedian. Thank you. He said, loved it so much. I immediately booked tickets for you in Leeds in June. Fact is, I wouldn't have done that had you not uploaded that hour for free. So thank you. I'm now a firmer fan. An even firmer fan than I was before. Thank you, Michael. Very much appreciated. Along the same lines, this is lovely. This is from Barry. Just wanted to say I've listened to your stand-up giveaway. It was brilliant. Very funny. Much funnier than I expected. I'd take more umbrage at that if you hadn't accidentally written "than I expected." I've been listening to your ComCom pod for about 3 or 4 years and always thought you seemed like a nice chap, but something made me think you wouldn't be my sort of stand-up. I was wrong. He goes on, you've given me so much free stuff, I feel obliged to buy tickets for a live show now. Anyway, thanks from a new fan who's been listening to you for a long time. Thank you, Barry. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone who has done the same thing. Thanks to everyone who has followed the flowchart in that same way. Listen, if this were a comedy podcast, it would be useful for building a comedy audience, a touring audience, in a particular way. Although it's a comedy podcast, we all know that it is about inquiry, and that doesn't necessarily suggest my ability to inquire and be curious and things like that doesn't necessarily suggest that I am funny. As I have said in the past, I've been made aware of a tendency to downplay my ability because I just feel I've earned the right to go, oh, what do you do, Stu? Ah, same old shit. I've earned that right by being good enough to kick that thing. Now look, I have played it down in the past, and God, I'm so English. I'm about to apologise now for having not... I'm about to apologise for having been too humble. I'm the worst. But listen, come and see me live. I'm really good. Barry thinks so. Michael thinks so. Check out Compared to What online. And that's on the podcast feed. Give that a listen. And if you enjoy it, come and see the new tour. It's called Like I Mean It and is going to play shortly in Nottingham, Reading, Corsham, Machynlleth, Bristol, Bath, Norwich, Northampton, Warwick, Shrewsbury, Swindon, Farnham, Aldershot, Sheffield, York, Newcastle, Leeds, Southampton, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Birmingham, Brighton, London, Tring, and Cardiff. So it is there's plenty of opportunities to check it out for yourself. So go to comedianscomedian.com/tour if you have enjoyed my free stuff and would like to see me live. I hope you will do that. And of course, you can go to comedianscomedian.com/donate if you would like to support the show instead of or as well as coming to see me live on tour. So from one nice chap to the space prince himself, let's get back to this fascinating conversation with Julio Torres.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Just tell us briefly about your background. You're from El Salvador.
Yes, I am from El Salvador, and I moved to America in 2009. And I always wanted to be in New York City. That's what I, growing up, and especially as a teenager, that's all I wanted to do. And the path to, the only path that made sense, of course, was going to school. Because, of course, I couldn't get a job because I had no education. So I, again, I literally Googled New York Liberal Arts College Scholarship International Student.
Okay.
And I found the new school that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was your what was it like growing up in El Salvador? I don't even have a stereotype of what El Salvador is like in my head.
Well, I guess if you have a stereotype of what growing up in Mexico City is, then I would equate it to that. I grew up in San Salvador, which is a very densely populated, very urban, very chaotic, very dangerous city. And I always feel like my experience growing up there is radically different than most people's experience growing up there, because ever since I was a kid, I thought, this is not where I should be. I don't like it here. So I'm just going to go ahead and wait for it to be over. So then I would really just go to school and then come back home and just wait for the next day. And I had, like, I think I made my first friend when I was, like, 18 or 19, maybe. Because I thought, well, I don't want to waste my time here. Because it's not where I want to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's, I've never heard anyone describe their school life in that way before. Did you have a sense that that was unusual?
A little bit. I think that there was always, and I dreaded this, at the beginning of every school year, a meeting in which the teacher called my parents to tell them that I wasn't talking to the other children, that I wasn't socializing, and asking if everything was okay at home. And everything was okay at home. I just was not into it. And looking back, it might have been a bit of also of a defense mechanism, of feeling like, oh, I'm different, so they're not going to like me anyway, so why bother, because I don't like them, so why don't we just respectfully stay out of each other's way?
And do you feel now that you missed out on any positive elements that you might have?
No.
You are one of the most composed people I think I've ever spoken to.
Yeah, when I moved to the States, a lot of people, family members, or maybe they were like, you know, you're gonna move and you're gonna miss it, and you're gonna find yourself being like, oh, like I wish I could like have this meal or this other thing, and I stay the course. I'm like, no, I made the right decision.
And were there any kind of, when you were at school, were there any kind of cultural influences in your life from which you were learning this kind of composure and the sort of the confidence in your decision being the right one? Was there a particular movie or a...
Oh, I see. I would devour anything that was set in New York City. I definitely glamorized that. And of course, when I moved, I found out that my experience there was going to be radically different than what I saw in TV and movies. But anything set in New York, I was obsessed with. I would watch a lot of American television. I feel like I would consume a lot of media as a kid. Like Ally McBeal was one of my favorite shows.
Okay.
I loved.
What did you love about Ally McBeal? What was it specifically that?
I loved. I distinctly remember thinking that Lucy Liu and Ally McBeal was just the coolest thing I've ever seen in the world, and I still believe that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess just the idea of a neurotic urbanite. I really love that. I would also watch I Dream of Jeannie. I remember loving it a lot. And I never really connected to it because I didn't want to, live a suburban American life. But I don't know. There was something about just the magic of it that I really liked.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about cool. Because you talked about Lucy Liu and Ally McBeal being cool.
Yeah.
And you are, I mean, you rarely in my life do I say this to people. You are cool as fuck. Oh, well,
thank you.
What does that mean? Like, why do you think I'm saying that? What is it about you that gets that reaction? I think that
I register in the human brain as cool because you're not used to... Because I'm a little different, I think. And because I am unwavering in the choices that I make. I don't know. I mean, this is such a cliche, but like, of course I didn't feel cool growing up. And I certainly didn't feel cool in college, where I was very studious and my only mission was to get perfect grades, because in my head, and boy was I wrong, that if I got perfect grades, then that's how I was going to stay in America.
Yeah. Okay.
I was dead wrong. That has absolutely nothing to do with anything. Because of course I'm like, sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm boring, but.
When did you first feel cool? And I know that's like, that's a poison chalice of a question, because as soon as you admit that you're cool, you're not cool anymore. But in the spheres in which we're talking.
In America, in college, yeah. I think that just coming from... Literally saying, like, people, someone asking, where are you from, saying El Salvador, I would get, oh, cool. And I thought, well, no, not really, which is why I left. Then I remember my roommate being, like, so excited that I was doing comedy and thinking that was really cool. And then when I was doing comedy, people thinking, oh, this guy's different than... the people who try to do comedy, and that is cool. And then with the magnifying of the, or exaggerating of the feeling alien and going platinum blonde, which in my brain is directly connected to that. People thought that was fun. Whereas always every decision I make is just very honest and very earnest.
Let's talk about the space prince.
Sure.
What does that mean to you? Is that a persona? Is it a kind of a North Star that you kind of? It's a direction rather than a person. What is it?
I think that it was. Well, first of all, literally, I had to like come up with an Instagram handle, right? But also, I thought like, oh yeah, that's sort of the thesis statement, that I am, one, not from here, but two, very in command of that. So I'm not from where you are and coming from a different place, but that doesn't make me less. It makes me sort of powerful and in control of that.
And it's also, you're not from where I am, but you're also not from where anyone else is.
Which is how I've always felt, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, like,
I feel there
aren't a load of space princes out there. You're the space prince.
Right. I strongly feel that to my peers in El Salvador, I am just as, if not more, foreign than my peers in America. Yeah.
Are you happy being unique? Or do you think, oh, it'd be great to find another space prince?
No, I think I'm pretty happy being unique. And but I don't know. Again, like, I don't feel like I'm outlandish or, because again, it's all very earnest. I don't know if I'm unique as much as I'm honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm attracted to people who are very honest with themselves as well. To people who understand themselves very well and know how to make something very productive out of that. I feel like all my friends who are performers or writers in New York, we're all very different, but what we have in common is we're very comfortable with the very specific thing that we bring to the conversation, and we relish in that. Because like you interviewing me right now and finding that I'm very different and all of these things, I have so many friends that I think are so special and odd and cool and unique, and I don't necessarily connect to their experience at all, but because they're so into what they're doing, I can connect to it.
So how long have you been doing stand-up?
Since 2013.
And within that time, what are some of the lessons that you have learned? I'm half expecting you to go, I didn't learn anything. Do you know what I mean? Like,
nothing,
I knew what I wanted,
learn anything.
And now I'm doing it.
Well, what are the lessons that I've learned? I think
I mean creatively as opposed to
to
get into...
What I always suspected, which was, if it's funny to me, then that's a good sign. and just, again, honesty and, sounds like such a stupid cliche, but like staying true to what you believe is funny or not funny. Because I remember the first time I tried doing stand-up, the very first time, and I found myself trying to mimic the body language of what I thought a stand-up should be. So the very first time I did stand-up, I took the microphone out of the stand, and I sort of leaned onto the stand, literally going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this is how a stand-up man performs, and then I do this, and then I, like, talk about where I'm from, and just in a cadence that was very rehearsed. And then I thought, oh, even if people found that funny, I don't, so, yeah.
And have you ever spotted that feeling again? Do you ever spot yourself falling into an appraisal of what your stand-up is, of what stand-up is, rather than what you now do? Like, do you ever, like,
no,
I suppose...
I think sometimes this very, like, comedian thing where, like, something happens in the news, and then everyone in the comedy world is commenting on it and has their, like, joke or take on it. And then I'm sort of, like, my gears are turning, and, like, what can I say about... And then I stop and go, like, nothing. I do not have a comedic take on that. So, nope.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's, like, I don't have to, like... It is not my homework or my duty to react to everything that Donald Trump says.
That is a really interesting framing of pretty much the same idea of, like, oh, we all take the mic out of the stand, like,
yeah.
No, there is no we, there is no all.
Right.
I do what I do. It's fairly easy to learn that lesson. But that's really interesting, I think, that it is exactly the same lesson to learn, that when everyone scrambles to make a joke on Twitter,
yeah,
you don't have to do that. Because that's what we all do, like, and there is no we all.
Some friends and I were laughing at, remember when Jared, the Subway guy from the Subway restaurants,
yes,
got arrested?
I know about that. I don't know if that's a well-known thing in the UK. But
oh,
I,
okay.
I,
So Subway, the sandwich chain, which you do have here, right?
We do have here, yeah.
Yeah.
But we never had Jared. He was, like, their poster.
Oh, I see. Yeah, the spokesman for it was this man, Jared, who... the claim was that he lost a lot of weight because he stopped eating hamburgers and he started eating Subway sandwiches instead. And he was this sort of, like, everyday guy, just this, like, very plain-looking man. And he was sort of the face of Subway sandwiches. And then... He was caught, I believe, with child pornography, right? Is that right?
I also believe so. Yeah, yeah. I think something like that. I don't want to... That's a terrible thing to accuse someone of if you're not fully over across the facts.
It was something bad. Really bad happened that he was guilty of. And when the news broke, it was, like, so comedic... Many people found it so comedically fertile because all the ingredients were there. It was... A silly sandwich shop, silly looking guy, and like a really disgusting thing. Mm-hmm. And my friends and I were laughing at, like, how some of the jokes that were posted on, like, Twitter and Facebook were, like, so hastily written because it was almost like, I've got to get this joke out now because the people need to hear what my...
Yes.
What my joke on the Jared Subway guy is going to be. And it's like, well, maybe it's not funny. Have you considered that maybe, like, we're not dying for your...
Have you... That's interesting. Do you come up against the need to write to order? Like, to, as opposed to, like, your stand-up practice where you go, this is everything that I'm, you know, I'm purely driven by what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
In your comedy life,
mm-hmm,
is there ever the requirement to write stuff about a subject you don't necessarily find funny? And how do you cope with that challenge? No.
No.
You have created the freedom.
Yeah, I don't...
God, that sounds idyllic. Or maybe do you find
that?
No, do you know what? No, I don't, but I always feel bad about that. I feel like, oh, if someone needed me to write specifically about this, then I'd be a failure because I wouldn't be able
to... But who needs you to write that?
Well, I don't know, like a TV show or a topical radio show or
something.
If hypothetically
I worked for a late night show
exactly,
and I was a joke writer, then what would my take on that be?
Yes.
Right.
But not, you know, I mean, but, sure. Or a radio show or anything.
Yeah. No. Luckily, I have been lucky that I've never had the... No one's ever pointed a finger and be like, quick.
Come up with a take on Jared.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is many people's job. And it's their job because they're good at it. Yeah. I have been lucky that I have... And this is a very privileged, I think, position where I feel like... If I'm not interested in it, then I just don't do it.
It's interesting you use the word lucky, because you don't strike me as someone who would attribute much to luck. You seem like a phenomenally determined, willful, hardworking, confident person.
Sure, but I...
Was there room for luck in that kind of... I feel like you kind of bend the world to your will. Isn't that what the Space Prince does? Using some sort of crystal?
Yeah, no, I don't know. Of course, I don't believe in luck. And I don't believe in... that anyone was meant to be anything. But that said, I do acknowledge that, you know, I came to America via scholarship... And I was very fortunate that was there for me.
Sure.
And I started doing comedy while I was struggling. But I was very fortunate that I wasn't struggling so much that I couldn't spare an hour a day to go do it. That I've always had some sort of flexibility in my life.
With someone with as strong, as clear of a comic voice as yours, I wonder, and maybe it's too early in your career for this to be the case, but I would imagine, if not now, then before too long, some newer comics will start to be influenced by you.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen that happen anywhere?
I think in a good way, I think. I think that what me and my peers do in our, like, uniqueness and specificity has allowed for the... It just sort of says, oh, you can also just do the thing that you thought no one was going to like. Yeah.
Yes.
Are they specifically mimicking literally what I do? I don't think so. I think that it's not a very appealing thing to
yeah, I mean,
mimic. It would feel like such a horrible prison if this was what you decided to, and also not necessarily a commercial hit. So, like, why would you bother doing that?
But that is a lovely way to contribute. If what you're effectively saying,
yeah,
if your
I think
influence
so.
Is, hey, you can just do what you love. Just pick a thing that you love and do it incredibly
right. Or it's not even pick a thing that you like.
No, discover. Be honest.
Yeah, of course.
So, what happens next in terms of your stand-up practice? Like, is it about, do you have ambitions or a plan towards getting a Netflix special of the Shapes show? Or, you know, what's your, are you a 5-year, 10-year plan person?
Oh God, 10 year to me feels like you might as well have said 100 years. That's like, again, I want things yesterday.
Yeah.
But
so what do you want yesterday?
I have a Comedy Central half hour coming out in October, which is very exciting. But now that I'm doing this Shape show, I'm just sort of thinking, well, what would my hour look like? And I keep thinking, and I'm sort of answering that question slowly. I'm thinking like, oh well, what about like hypothetically a stand-up hour where we all of a sudden pan away from me and we start zooming in very closely into a little object somewhere else. And then we sort of go into the thoughts of that object, and then we see go into like the world of that, and then we suddenly like zoom out and I'm still doing a stand-up set or something like that.
Yes, okay.
So I'm still figuring out what the sort of what my version of that would look like.
And do you have other kind of does the space prince have other interests than shapes and objects? Are there things similar in tone that are fertile for further hours?
Would it be great if I said no?
No. <It's> so great.
No. No, I think that I'm a very visual person. So it being visually right and specific will always carry that. But no, I'm interested in exploring points of views that I think haven't been sufficiently explored. And when I say that, I also include, like, objects. But also just, I feel like we haven't sufficiently seen an immigrant perspective in a way that is... We haven't seen enough of that, so I think that I'm very interested in exploring that. And I feel like still a very specific kind of voice dominates the conversation. And I feel like you tune into shows night after night, and there are all these wonderful shows, but it's always like... the same type of person getting laughs on behalf of people who don't get to be on TV.
Yes.
Like, we all cheer that, like, yeah, like, oh, yes, he's, like, standing up for them. Well, what if they stood up for themselves?
Yes.
And they were on TV, you know? So I'm interested in that.
And is there, in your few, I mean, do you direct? Do you do cinematography as well as write? Because it seems to me that like
sure.
A writer with a visual fixation is sort of...
That is certainly an ambition that I hope to conquer soon, which is directing. Yeah. Because I've been lucky that I've been put in positions where I'm so happy that I have worked with really great people that are like visually very connected to what I do and very wonderful directors so far, but I that's like a skill that I want to attain myself.
And is there, I mean, you seem very well built for being a director, a kind of auteur figure. You know what you want.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's where I hope this goes to.
So just, I'm trying to preemptively ask questions that I would ask you in 5 or 10 years when you've directed something. What sort of things, I mean, within the scope of comedy, mm-hmm. or does your directorial ambition see beyond comedy? Is it about finding what's funny in the visual, or is it about finding what's surprising in the visual, or what's previously unfound?
I think what's surprising in the visual, and I think that sometimes I do wonder, like, am I a comedian? Or am I just earnestly doing work that people just happen to find funny?
That's the first note of doubt. We're on 56 minutes.
All right.
The first question mark.
That's
fascinating.
But no, the answer is I am a comedian because I do write jokes.
Of course.
But sometimes I feel like, because I find beauty to be so stimulating and just gorgeous shots and just beautiful gowns and just beautiful objects, I find myself very connected and drawn to beauty. So I think that is to me just as important as it being funny.
And are there moments of doubt? Do you have the same artistic doubts that other artists would suffer from? Do you think, is this funny? Is this working? Is this for me?
This being my pursuit of this career, or?
Yes. Yeah, your pursuit of the career or the material. Like, if you have a tough show, if you have a bad show, if an audience doesn't get it, does that roll off you like Teflon? Like, no, they didn't go for it. Or do you ever doubt that maybe, or do you have any doubts?
No, I never doubt that I'm doing what I should be doing. That I don't doubt. And when something goes wrong, I have objective evidence that proves that show went wrong, but the material isn't bad because previous audiences have found it funny.
Well, I'm trying to relate this to my own life in the hope that I can learn some like of your self-belief.
If you bomb with material that has previously done well, then you know that something happened that doesn't mean that your material is bad.
Yes, that's true. Although I suppose my initial reaction would be, as the kind of bag of nerves that I am, I would go on stage if I was bombing. I suppose I would tend historically to think, I am terrible at this. I've been found out.
Oh,
those other times they were lucky. Do you know what I mean? In the face of like an illogical, emotive way.
No, well, first of all, I never resent the audience for not liking what I do.
Sure.
But I do think, I'm just not what they like. And I know that I'm not for everyone. So, yeah.
So what does that mean to the editing of the material, say, when you're working on a joke and it doesn't go down?
Yeah.
And you think that joke needs to be improved. I need to tweak the joke. I need to rewrite the joke. Early in the life of the joke.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yes. I mean, very productive moments have come from something not going right and then me moving it around and either getting rid of it or
so
keeping
it. So do you suffer from, not suffer, do you experience the same, like, I'm trying a new joke, I hope this works. If it doesn't work, what does that mean if a new joke doesn't work? Does that mean that they're wrong, or does that mean that you're wrong, or that the joke isn't ready yet?
It meant that the way I presented this idea was not the right one.
Because you have absolute confidence that the belief itself is funny. That's the bit I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Because even before anyone's laughed at it.
The vessel I presented this idea in is not the right one yet.
Because
and
every
then it goes back.
Sorry.
And then this idea goes back to the cloud, and then I will find a different vessel to present the thesis in.
So, do you ever have a bad idea, or is every idea you have, by virtue of its existence, it is communicable somehow?
Yeah, I think it is. When I come to the audience with an idea, it may be rough and it may be, and the joke may be all wrong and, it may be sloppy or whatever, but I think that the thesis statement, by that time I have questioned it enough that there is something there.
So before that point, before it comes to the audience, when it pops into your head as an idea and you make a note of it, and then you review your notes, some of them, are you thinking, that one is not an idea? Like, is every idea that pops into your head that is recorded, you go, that will work in some form, Or is there any kind of thing where you go, that is, I made a mistake when I thought of that because that is not funny?
I think that is not funny as a sentence. Let's try it as something else. Yeah, I think like, oh, that is, like sometimes I'll have an idea and think like, oh, this is not a bad idea. It's just not a joke. Let's save it for when I like literally design a garment.
That's an incredible way to think of it. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. This, yeah, because there isn't a bad idea. There's just an idea that isn't actually a joke.
Yeah.
That's an incredible way to never feel negative about your output. Maybe like, you know, maybe there's a bad comic out there now and really he's not a bad comic. It's just, he's a great dress designer. He's a great garment designer who doesn't know it.
Yeah.
And as a result is taking these things on stage every night, which will only ever be good garments.
Yes. I
what a wonderful way to see creativity.
I agree with that. And just a very mundane everyday example of that is, I think, comedians who on stage perform tweets that did very well on the internet. And the audience doesn't react to them. And it's like, well, why is it bad that it was a really funny tweet? Like, why does it have to be a joke that you say on stage?
Yes.
Why can't you just relish on that you wrote something funny? Why is this a failure? It isn't. You just, like, try to do something with it that it wasn't meant to be.
I'm trying to find holes in this logic, because if this thesis is correct, this is the.
I remember when I took an aptitude test in like my senior year of high school, because I thought it would be productive, and I think it was. Do you know what that is, when you take a test and they tell you what career you're suited
for? Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And my mother's an architect and my father is a civil engineer, and they were both very keen on the idea of me also being an architect because I was always very visual. And I had gotten to my head by that point already that I wanted to be a writer. And I took an aptitude test, and the test determined that my abilities were suited to be an architect. And I said, well, how about writing? What did the test say about that? And it said that it seemed okay, but that I would never be as good as a writer as I would be as good as an architect or anything that had visual intelligence to it. So now I'm sort of... But I didn't want to do that. So now I'm borrowing from that part of my brain to do what I do want to do. Yeah.
That is, I mean, we talked about garments, but maybe also there's something about writing jokes and going, that's not a joke.
That's a building.
That's a building. That's a floor plan. That's a floor plan. Oh, God, yeah. All of these are windows.
Yeah.
Here am I standing in a comedy club trying to tell windows.
Right.
That is an absolutely fascinating way to look at it. Thank you.
Because I think my whole thing, my what drives me, what I love doing is creating. So they don't have to be jokes all the time, and that's okay.
And do you feel that you have been born at exactly the right time, given how much internet there is, given how much Instagram and video and ability there is to create visually, to have your jokes and your windows seen for free,
maybe,
by
yeah,
millions of people.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, or I don't know, maybe
like,
I would have found
like... Who
would
you have been as an 80s comedian? what would that have looked like?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely, there are like realms that I don't experiment in because my brain just doesn't work that way. I'm not a very musical person at all, and I'm very deficient when it comes to that. And so I don't even try it. But I think I sort of equate what I do to people being productive and funny with music.
Do you have, in the same way that I might have a favorite joke, or you might have a favorite joke, do you have a favorite image? Do you have certain images that you would enjoy?
Yeah, I think that, to me, one of the funniest jokes are Fabergé eggs, and I will never cease to find them so deeply funny.
Because talk me through it,
Expensive things that you can have multiple of, and they're so preposterous in how they look, and it's just, they're so ridiculous, and the fact that people like collect these very expensive things in a way that is so deeply serious is so funny to me, because it's essentially an egg in a dress. it's just this egg, which is inherently such a funny shape, with like bows and diamonds encrusted. It's just so funny to me.
So is there anything in your show? Is there anything no longer in your show? Have you
yes.
cut anything in the making
yes.
of this show?
A lot.
What sorts of things have you cut, and what were the decisions?
Pieces that took too long. Pieces that structurally did the same as parts of it that I think are better that are currently on the show. Mm-hmm. Like, there are several moments in the show where I have a very dry conversation between two people. Mm-hmm. I was drowning in those at the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. So I pick and chose. And also just very, like, logistical, sensible decisions, like, oh, I'm touching on Melania Trump. Do I also need to touch on Ivanka Trump? And to a foreign audience, when I go back and forth from a Melania bit to an Ivanka thing, are they going to picture the same woman? Because phonetically their names are so close, and mm-hmm. we know that they're close to the president. And like, are they going to picture Melania when I'm talking about Ivanka, or vice versa?
I was struck in particular by the swans.
Yeah.
And the relationship between the swans.
Yes.
And the intrusion upon that relationship of the third swan.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know how many people will get to see the show who've seen this, or will be able to see it if it's released.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I hope people can see it somewhere. But it struck me that it is what you're doing is sort of social satire, almost.
Sure.
Through the medium of glass swans. So
yes.
you're talking about this relationship, the intrusion upon the relationship, and how we would all react at the oncoming wedding of these two original swans.
Yeah.
And I don't even know really what the question is, other than how much I love that bit. When it seemed to me to typify what you do, which is to show an apparent thing.
Yeah.
And then the comedy isn't the thing itself. The comedy is how you bring yourself to the thing and how we bring ourselves to the thing. And how the thing is almost it's not a skeleton or like some sort of lattice. It's like, there we go. This is, the object is simply the thing that holds all of the
opinions
the, and
yeah,
stories
it's the,
around.
It's the vessel. It's
the vessel, of course, the vessel.
The glass swans are actors in this little play that people can connect to, I think. That's how I see it. And I just made, like, right casting choices.
Let's bring it back to your persona. The material that you have about someone shouting birthday girl on the street.
Yes.
And the punchline, to butcher the punchline with apologies, is that on hearing someone shout birthday girl in the street, you say, for a second, the world was mine.
Yes.
And that is, I tell you what, one of the things I love about what you do is that it would be completely impossible for anyone to steal it, you know, because it doesn't even work necessarily written down. It's so, you're
sure.
so infused with you, you're the vessel.
So what is the question?
I don't know what the question is. I was sort of, when you said I was like, brilliant. I didn't have a question. Yeah, he's running with it somehow.
And sometimes I do wonder if that helps or hurts, that, oh, this is so uniquely me that no one else could do it or say it. Sometimes I challenge the relatability of the joke and think, and then we go back to the whole question of,
yes,
is this a funny joke or is this funny because they're like, what is this person?
Yes.
But I do think that I do really firmly believe that joke in particular is relatable.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But I also think that to come back to that issue, if you're then directing, and obviously you write, mm-hmm, for certain things that you don't perform, and you are not present in those, but you are present through your writing. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the next development of that is in terms of directing, given that that particular vessel is not there on stage to relate to. But you still, in your non-stand-up writing, mm-hmm, it's still incredibly of you. And I wonder what the next stage is in terms of your direction, how you find a way to infuse the work that you direct.
Sure. Well, I think that, like, you know, you think of any director with a very specific voice, you don't see them, but when you see their film, you're walking into their brain. And the rules of that universe are so specific to that film that you don't question it. Like I just went to see the most recent Sofia Coppola movie, and I love Sofia Coppola. And by the way, I feel like the Sofia Coppola of The Fringe, because it's so, I'm so slow and patient and visually driven, and a lot of audiences are very frustrated by that. but I feel her, and I feel her point of view, and I feel her perspective, and I feel that she is there, even though I don't know that I can even tell what her voice sounds like.
Yes. So, to wrap up, what kind of motifs do you imagine the Julio, the director? What sorts of things would you have a sense that we would see?
A sense of alienness, beauty, the sense of not belonging and thriving in that, making the most out of what you have.
Are those things which are more well-worn as directorial tropes than they are as stand-up comedy tropes?
Sure, maybe.
It would be harder to be noticed in the visual world, whereas at the moment you're bringing visual stuff to a non-traditionally visual art form.
Sure,
that
maybe.
Sounds like that could really be more challenging to stand out than it is in this form. It's like, it's almost like sometimes what really goes off in comedy is when people sidestep from an existing genre into, mm-hmm, comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And stepping out of it, you'd be doing, you know, maybe a...
I always see what you're saying, that because that visual is... that medium is inherently visual.
Yeah.
Then it's like... Well, yeah, that's a gorgeous...
Another guy, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a gorgeous shot. That's what you're meant to do. That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that... No, I'm not scared of that. I don't think that... I think that I'll find something specific and different in that realm. Yeah, no, I'm not worried about that.
Are you happy?
Yes. Yeah, I'm very happy. I think that I, day by day, become a happier person. I was a very unhappy child. And then I was a little bit better as a teenager. And then I every decision that I make has made me happier. Yeah. I mean, my life isn't perfect, obviously. But I become easily frustrated, I will say that. And I'll go into days where all I did was be really angry about that one problem. But overall, I'm a pretty happy person. I don't believe in this whole thing of comedians have to be unhappy to be funny, when my whole show is, let me show you the things that really make me happy so that you can also be happy.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Julio, for coming on the show. What an experience. I really recommend you get yourself online and search for Wells for Boys, which is a sketch that Julio wrote, and it gives you a real sense. From there, just dive into an absolute rabbit hole of his really fascinating live work online and his online presence and all the interesting things he gets up to. Really, really fun. Julio Torres, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you to Nathan for listening to, I meant editing, but he does have to listen to the fucking thing. Thanks to Nathan Wood for producing this show. And thanks to you for listening to it, for leaving positive reviews on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcast, particularly if you're on Android and you have one or several of the increasingly obscure podcast apps, then comments and reviews on there, on however you might put them, they're really helpful, provided they're positive. Nope, just positive. That's the only helpful one. If you didn't enjoy it, you almost certainly won't be listening this far. And of course, if you are interested in following more or finding out more or joining the kindred spirits of the ComCom Pod community, then search for the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook group. And you have to answer a question in order to join, which is just to tell me whereabouts you heard of the show. You can use that as an opportunity to have a little bit of correspondence with you if you like. People have been doing that. And that's been a lot of fun. Very high level of inquiry and invigorating conversation about lots of different elements of the podcast and the wider stand-up and creative world on there. Now, no postamble this week. The postamble is going to be dedicated to the memory of Barry Crimmins, who was a guest on this show last year, and someone who I had a lot of respect for. And I'm really so sorry to hear about his loss. I think when people who are important in the comedy firmament pass away, it's sort of important to honour them honestly. I would love to be able to say I knew Barry better than I did. I only met him three times, twice at the Montreal Festival. We shared a really bad breakfast together, myself and Barry and Tiffany. And then I saw him again briefly in Montreal. And then when I saw him in London for that episode of the podcast, he had clearly forgotten that we were going to meet and did it anyway, which speaks volumes to me about how respectful he was and how much integrity he had. I met him in a hotel foyer. He was having a chat with a friend and was surprised to see me and had forgotten that we were going to record the episode. And even though he was exhausted, and you can hear how shattered he is really from that episode, of which I remain extremely proud, he came along and gave us all an hour of his time. He was a remarkable man. I cannot recommend enough that you watch his output, the documentary Call Me Lucky. He also has a stand-up special on Netflix. And I think you'll enjoy that episode as well. He redefined comedy in Boston and was an incredible leading light of the, I don't know, I call it agitprop on Facebook, which is the wrong word, but as a political agitator and comic and free thinker, he was a really remarkable man, and in the short amount of meetings that I had with him, I found him incredibly warm. He looked like such a gruff, cantankerous bastard, and I found him to be amazingly passionate, articulate, friendly, and I was very deeply saddened to hear about his loss. So rest in peace, Barry Crimmins, and thank you. That's all for today. I will speak to you next week. Thanks for listening.
And do download that episode with Barry if you get the chance. It's really very special.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.